You are listening to www.integralnaked.org.
This talk is entitled Integral Transformative Practice, Part 2, Understanding States and Stages, featuring George Leonard, Mike Murphy, and Ken Wilber.
We've talked about the whole bringing the integral turning of the wheel from the idealist in Aurobindo up to the present, and we're really at Esalen, and there's no question in my mind, and I'm not saying this to be nice, Mike, you know I've said this before, that I'm in print with this, that I think Mike Murphy has done more to help transformation in this era than anybody else, if for no other reason than the spaces he created in which other people can transform. And I deeply believe that, in addition to your own work. And I think Esalen was, precisely because it was a nobody captures the flag, precisely because it was a crucible dedicated to experiment and evidence and experience, was the fountain out of which this great integral movement, and it was an integral movement, even if it was in many cases it was just parts and pieces and trial and error and little bits over here and little bits over there. It all added up and it all played an important part. And what we're seeing now is, and I also think history is going to record the partnership that you two had and the special relationship that you and George had, because I think in many, many ways that the outreach portion of that was a special collaboration in many ways on y'all's part, and I think that's really, really exquisite. And
well, I never would have done ITP without George. George proposed it to me. You know, he had read The Future of the Body in its various drafts, and then he had developed a variety of practices. You know, not only Aikido. I mean, George is, certainly he's the best known Aikidoist in America.
Yeah.
But also the Leonard Energy Training,
right,
and various other things. And then he proposed that we put all our works together. We'd been doing it in various other ways. But so, yes, it was this collaboration, and out of it came ITP. But I wouldn't have done it if George hadn't proposed it.
Which is what I think is so great, though, if we could just bring it up into, indeed, focus on the 19th century, and particularly leading up to the human potential movement in this country, because you two were pioneers in that very specifically. And, I mean, we also have the gentleman on the phone who named it the human potential movement. So I'm just curious how you would, and let's just exempt ourselves from this discussion now so we don't fall all over each other expressing our admiration, which is very genuine. But where do you pick this up? I mean, I see, we obviously have heroes into the 19th century. One of mine, of course, is James Mark Baldwin, who is the first really genius developmental psychologist and actually influenced everybody from Piaget to Kolber, Keegan. Everybody is standing in James Mark Baldwin's shadow on this, and he was around the turn of the century. But when we get right into the 50s and 60s and 70s, we really pick up the story with people like Aldous Huxley and Abe Maslow and folks like that. And how do you see it unfolding from there, the sort of integral turning during those years?
You're talking from late 50s on?
Sure, right around then. Sure, the last half of the century.
Well, Esalen, of course, did play a role. I mean, with its various excesses, and but we were a place of experiment. And from the very beginning, Dick Price and I really went shoulder to shoulder that we weren't going to let anyone capture the flag.
Right.
It was going to be a place for wide open exploration. So some of the things that emerged there, for me, in fact, I've started to outline my own little intellectual history just as an exercise. I've started work on that and the step-by-step process of discovery, looking back. But first of all, it was, I can speak from my own experience here. Well, first of all, we had and particularly I had a guiding philosophy that was much shaped by Aurobindo, that there was this evolving, this, let's call it evolutionary panentheism, I mean, that was implicit, this Aurobindonian or evolutionary non-dualism, whatever you want to call it. So there was an attempt to get people who were either explicitly or implicitly or tangentially related to that. Huxley gave nice language with his talk about human potentialities.
Right.
But then, discovering Maslow, you had to have him there. He synchronistically appeared down there before our programs had even started.
Yeah.
It was like a sign we were on the right track.
Yep.
And then Fritz Perls came, but then Fritz Perls brought Ida Rolf, Alan Watts brought Charlotte Selver, X brought Y.
Yep.
Pretty soon, there was what you would call a natural coalescence. And then these people started to lead programs. And for a number of years, it kind of fleshed itself out. I was the primary programmer, but people who saw affinities would bring them.
Right.
So at some point, the impulse arose in a number of us to try to make some sort of sense out of all this and find some order in it. And I proposed to the Ford Foundation in 1967, along with a program in what became Confluent Education with George Brown, that we bring these various practices together in kindergarten through 12th grade curricula.
Right.
But at the same time, to do an inventory of ways people grow.
Yep.
And so for 2 years, Severin Peterson and others worked on that. We came up with an inventory of 200 major approaches that included approximately 10,000 techniques. An approach would be, say, psychoanalysis. The techniques would be dream interpretation,
right,
analysis of defenses, et cetera. Hatha yoga had all its hundreds, and et cetera, et cetera. And to look at that, and that kept going. Then I wanted to have this residential program, and George was the first person I turned to. We had just met in February of 65, and by the end of 65, we were putting together this residential program. Now, I wouldn't term it a success in any way, but in a way, it was a forerunner of ITP, wouldn't you say, George? It was. So what I'm trying to say here is, Ken, in response to your question, there was, from the 50s on, and Esalen was probably the prime place where it happened, a coming to view within a general, some sort of framework, or into a single purview, this wide range of approaches, some of them somatic, physical, some interpersonal, psychodynamic, psychological, some of them purely mental, ways to increase your mind, some of them spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
And then out of that came the impulse to find order, relationship, and comprehensive practices.
Right.
So now that was one turn of the wheel right there, a kind of Cambrian explosion of techniques.
And cataloging them.
Well, first, providing a place for them,
then
the invention of them. Now, there was a lot of invention going on, and pretty soon we began to see, you know, here comes somebody with the latest therapy.
Yeah.
And I got it. It was a repackaging of something that had been out there for a long time.
Yeah.
This person thought they had discovered it. It was a kind of Cambrian explosion.
Yeah.
And but then, as always, you have to have the survival of the fittest. There's a Darwinian selection process. And there was one, for example, that was quickly extinguished, called psychic karate. Do you remember that, George?
Yeah.
And this consisted of a kind of high-energy psychodrama that's a miracle everyone survived. People would stagger out into the dining room and lay there on the floor while others were eating and be dragged in by the heels back into the... When I said they couldn't do it anymore, I got every single person in that group said, Murphy, you have no gojones at all. You say you're for this, and I wrote back to all of them and said, look, it just is ruining everybody's lunch. We can't handle it. Go away. But it turned out that nobody could handle this particular leader. It was just too much. Well, that's been repeated a lot. There's been a lot of Darwinian selection in these not only techniques, but I would call it packages of virtues that get smuggled in, inadequate packages of virtues, and then pathological communities that develop around some of these approaches. So the culture's been sorting out this Cambrian explosion. Now, that's one of the turns in the wheel. And, of course, the embrace of all our parts. The somatics movement, I mean, includes every sort of species. You know, you got Emily Conrad Daoud, where you just lay there 15 hours a day attending to the micro-movements of not only your muscle fibers, but she thinks down to your cellular level, all the way up to this Neo-Reichian stuff where they really break down your character armor in these convulsive movements and et cetera, et cetera. So it's been a huge amount of experimentation like that. And then comes the sorting out impulse, and then, of course, in your work, Ken, you've been perhaps the most, well, you certainly have been the most thoroughgoing contextualizer and finding conceptual order in a lot of this, or all of this stuff. And George and I have done our own contextualizations and our own effort to get an orderly and powerful practice.
And George, you came into this, one of the things that struck me about the last conversation that you and I had that I sort of knew in the back of my mind but hadn't given sufficient attention to, and which a lot of people really appreciated hearing. And that was that for the integral side of the human potential movement, a large impetus came from the civil rights movement. In other words, the civil rights movement was part and parcel of human potential movement.
Very much so. I really saw that as a sort of a model. And another thing that so inspirited me, and maybe over-inspirited me, how fast the changes could occur, was the fact that the civil rights movement created changes in my native South, which beforehand they would seem absolutely impossible.
Yeah.
There were men, especially older than I was then, and my age as well, who said to their friends and to themselves, and they truly, deeply believed it, that they would be willing to get their guns out and go to war
yep.
again in order to keep a Negro from being in the class with
yep.
their daughter.
Yep.
And the fact that in a period of very few years, those huge changes occurred, whether people liked it or not, the changes occurred. That gave me hope when I first met Mike that, hey, we can really move fast. Of course, you can't move that fast to get these really deep down changes. It had been percolating since the Revolution when they had to postpone the racial problem. And then the Constitutional Convention, again, they postponed it
yep.
consciously,
yep.
our founding fathers. And then we had to fight a war, and we won the war, saying we with the North now, as a Southerner. And then everybody just got tired of it and let the South take over again with the whole sharecropper idea. So the American Revolution was not really completed until the late 1960s.
And in a sense, yeah, which I think is really important to remember for several reasons. And one is that it's obviously an integral approach for us. One of the ways that I talk about it, as you know, is the simplest way to talk about it. It's much more complex than this. But to me, the simplest acceptable definition of integral for today's world is it seeks to exercise body, mind, and spirit in self, culture, and nature. And the body, mind, and spirit is sort of the spectrum of consciousness or the levels in the great chain or however you want to think about that. And self, culture, and nature, or I, we, and it, or the good, the true, and the beautiful, are the quadrants. And so you want to have all quadrant, all level approach. And the culture, the change in culture, is what civil rights reminded us can be done. There's a higher conception of human nature in self that was embodied in culture, and that was extremely important.
That's
and,
well put.
Well, thanks. And the last thing I want to say about that, too, is that if you look at the lower right quadrant, the techno-economic mode, and this is another reason we have to be integral, 97% of agrarian societies have slavery.
Yeah.
0% of industrial societies have slavery. It's no accident that the North was industrial and the South was agrarian.
Yeah.
And until we had an industrial set of values, and this is industrial in a positive sense, meaning world-centric values, then we really couldn't get rid of slavery. And so that's another part of an integral approach, is looking at all the quadrants and all the levels. But it's so important in the human potential movement that this point that George is making it be added to the points that we're making. I know we all agree on this, but my experience is that any human potential movement that leaves out body or mind or spirit and leaves out self or culture or nature gets in trouble.
They're yeah.
not being integral.
A lot of people want to say Esalen is moved from the me to the we. But I do have to say that we, from the beginning, kept talking about the coevolution of personal and social transformation.
Absolutely.
You know, I remember in 1963...
You had workshops on it, on race relations.
Oh, we had workshops. You know, for example, the whole thing with China. In 1963, we had quite a meeting down there on that. And a lot of stuff on ecology. In the early days, we had to define for our readers what ecology meant. You know, it's funny, that was a new word in the 60s.
Yeah, I know.
They would have confused it with ethology.
Yeah.
And people say, well, you're studying animals? And I say, no, ecology. So we'd have to define it. It was a new coinage.
Yeah.
And, but, yes, amen.
You know, we're sort of talking about the general scientific spirit, and learning is trial and error. And anybody in science will tell you, Karl Popper's made a fetish out of it, but anybody in science will tell you that failures are just as important as successes. You learn just as much.
Amen. Oh, God, that's great.
You know, and it's so important for that. And
amen.
I look back in the last 30 years, and half of the stuff that I learned, you know, really important lessons, were just catastrophic failures. From failures, we learn this stuff. And then there's all the positive things that we learn. We have all this wonderful cataloging that you were talking about, and this, you know, thousands of techniques and what they can do and what they can't do. And now we're right at the point, I really believe, looking back now on the 30 years that we've all sort of been involved in this, that it's just at this time that we can even begin to integrate all of those differentiations and all of those new emergent practices.
I look back at the 65 residential program. Both Fritz Perls and Dick Price said to me, this is premature. They were not against it. But I think one of the great lessons for, well, for me and George, I think, we write about it, you know, in The Life We Are Given, is... you know, we went along with this Big Bang theory of enlightenment, you know, that was in the air. It was this American optimism plus the power of these experiences.
Satorian, 7 days.
And, you know, exactly. I mean, enlightenment in a weekend.
Exactly.
And so, you know, part of my process was saying, well, we got to have 5-day workshops, and then it'll take.
Yeah.
But then... people would go home, and instead of the glow wearing off on Tuesday, at least it would last till Thursday.
Right.
So then from there, you know, it did occur to me, well, we'll do it for 9 months.
Yeah.
And then that'll take. Well, this is when people got in trouble, was about 2 or 3 months after they left.
Yeah.
Well, again, Michael, with those, it was they were constantly trying for the climactic moment at all times, rather than the whole long plateaus of the learning curve that are really necessary. And we didn't understand that at the time.
And we have, there's a point now where the theoretical research on this has gotten to a point where we can make preliminary conclusions about this. And I know y'all, we've talked about this before, but to me it's one of the really important tentative conclusions that we've come to. And that is, in the more complex integral model, we talk about not just quadrants and levels, but quadrants, levels, lines, states, and types. And levels and lines, levels, another word for levels is stages or waves of development. And so you have stages of consciousness, and you have states of consciousness, and states of consciousness include peak experiences and altered states, psychedelic states, meditative states, and so on. And stages of development are any of the sort of stable patterns of unfolding that have been researched by Claire Graves or Abe Maslow or Jane Lovinger or Carol Gilligan and so on. And both of them are important. They both occur. Both have to be taken into account along with quadrants and types and so on. But there's a couple of recurrent conclusions that keep coming back to us. And one is if you take any stage conception you want, and for the moment we can just use the 7 chakras as a rough stage conception just because there are 7 levels and it's like the great chain. And the chakras are many things, but we can just treat them as a stage conception for right now. You can be at any stage. You can be at third stage, third chakra, and you can have a peak experience of a gross or subtle or causal state. You can have a meditative state. You can have an experience of oneness with nature. You can have a mystical state that's temporary. It can be very profound. It can change people's lives. But it comes, it stays a bit, and it goes. And most importantly, what we find is you tend to interpret your state of consciousness based on your stage of consciousness. So somebody at the magic level or the mythic level or the mental level, using Gebser, if somebody's at the mythic level, they'll tend to interpret that altered state in mythic terms, maybe seeing an actual Christ figure or some other form of concrete mythic figure, not some actual subtle body or something. So one of the conclusions is that you can be at virtually any stage and have an enormous number of state experiences or peak experiences. You tend to interpret those according to the stage that you're at. But the other conclusion, which I find very interesting, is that there's a fair amount of empirical research showing that the more you're dunked into altered states of consciousness, including meditative states, the faster you develop through stages. So it's as if every time you have an altered state, it's a micro disidentification process. It shakes loose whatever identification or attachment you have just a little bit, and you can move to a subtler, higher, deeper stage.
When you say this is empirical, I mean, whose research are you thinking of there?
Roger Walsh has correlated a lot of this. Some of it came out of, the initial stuff came out of TM, but other types of meditation research. And Suzanne Cook-Reuter, who's Jane Lovinger's main successor, has done a great deal of research on this.
The altered states relation.
Yes, and meditative states. Well, I'll give you a really quick example. Is you can take people using the Jane Lovinger scale of development, which is a very sophisticated scale, very hard to fake, and there's approximately 2% of the average college population is at her 2 highest stages, which she called autonomous and integrated, and are roughly equal to yellow and turquoise in the spiral dynamic scheme. After 4 years of meditation, that 2% goes to 38%. But nobody skips stages. And it's very similar to what Aurobindo said, which is you can accelerate speed through the stages, but you can't permanently skip stages. And so there's a fair amount of research suggesting that. What I like about that is it allows us to be inclusive and integral again, because there's an enormous amount of research on developmental stages, and there's an enormous amount of research on states of consciousness. And people, again, usually get in trouble if they try to leave one or the other out.
Yeah, that is really important.
I feel the same way. That is very important.
It's good stuff because, again, the research on both of these, the research on meditative states, we know that there are phenomenologically meditative states, and the amount of research on that, really, and just even our ordinary experience tells us that that's the case. And there's a great deal of research on various stages. And so what we're seeing is, I think, very important, because I sort of technically phrase it by saying anytime you have an altered state that is bigger than your interpretive capacity at the moment, then it forces you to grow. And that's basically what happens. You're moving. It disidentifies you with your present stage, and you can move to a higher stage. You can't skip stages, not true stages. So that's an interesting piece of information, because what it gives to both sides of that argument, their proper due. People can go into a weekend encounter group, for example, have a big bang, and it's important. They can have an experience of causal formlessness. They can have an experience of subtle oneness with deity. They can have an experience of gross unity with all of nature. But they come back out, and if they're at red or blue or magic or mythic, or if they're at stage 3 or 4 or 5 in moral development, they're, you know, that's where they're going to be. But it slowly helps them transform to higher stages. So that's where both a weekend workshop can be helpful, but ITP is necessary, because it's the integral transformative practice that converts temporary states into permanent traits through stage
development. George, isn't it fair to say we have not used this formulation in ITP that Ken's unpacking for us here.
It would be very, very useful tonight.
Yeah,
I think, bring it up.
I think we should start introducing this one right here.
It's
implicit, Ken, in everything we do.
It is implicit,
but it's useful here to unpack it. Now, one of the good things, George, I think the way we're working with our gang here, you know, in various formats and in various ways, is a kind of slowly evolving language of how to talk about all of this and how to make it practical, you know.
Right.
But anyway, this is very, very important.
The year that The Life We Are Given and SES came out, in a sense, mid-90s, 1995-ish, was, I think, a real opening for this stuff. And I think that is a confluence and a coming together.
Absolutely.
Of all of these currents.
No, there's definitely, that is an obvious confluence.
And Future of the Body, and I mean, you know, and George's whole education ecstasy mastery, I mean, all of that.
Well, this thing is, you know, our work has been co-evolving here for 30 years.
Sure.
And we're still unpacking it.
Yep.
I mean, it's constantly emergent. It's an emergent phenomenon.
Let's try to plan one of these again, but then let's really sit down and talk about all the pragmatics of ITP and what's required and what we know about it and where we need to go from here.
Oh, George, wouldn't that be good? Let's frame
really
some of the central questions.
Exactly.
Ken, when you become a traveling man again, you ought to come down to this thing.
I know.
You ought to come down, at least come down.
I know.
Come down at least for bring a friend and just come down for a night.
I know. I tell you, if I do anything, that's top of the list. I guarantee it. That's so important.
Everybody would be thrilled if you were there.
Oh, well, you're in a helicopter.
Listen, the Beatles came in a helicopter down there.
And so did Werner Earhart.
And Werner Earhart.
There you go.
So you.
I'm in good company. That's right.
Okay, guys.
Okay, it's wonderful talking with y'all.
Thanks, George.
Oh, thank you both.
Bye now.
All right.
We hoped you enjoyed part 2 of this presentation. Stay tuned for part 3, airing in the near future. You are listening to www.integralnaked.org.